The Glass Show can be found on Podomatic and iTunes. On Podomatic, the address is chrismcgovernmusic.podomatic.com. On iTunes, go to the iTunes store, type in The Glass Show, S-H-O, and it should be the second entry under podcasts. Click on the Glass Show, and it's going to feature my picture, the one with the hat on. Click on that picture, and it brings you to the Glass Show page. And basically, click on subscribe, and you will hear every episode, or every new episode. And of course, while you're there, you can listen to any episode you want that you haven't, or if you want to hear it over and over again, or any favorite of yours, you can just always just put them on. And anyway, to your wonderful delight, they have several ways of playing these pieces on any little device that you have, any big device that you have. Basically, the sky's the limit as far as iTunes goes. And follow The Glass and The Glass Show on Facebook. And follow me on Twitter. I'm at CMC The Glass Show. And of course, the original website that started it all is theglassblogismine.com for The Glass. And thank you so much for being a fan. I really appreciate it. This is Chris McGovern, and you're listening to The Glass Show. Thank you. Welcome to the Glass Show. I'm Chris McGovern. That's the Carillion 1 and 2 by Jeff Myers. There's a third one as well. All of them are available on his website, jeffmyersmusic.com. Essentially, like, you can find any and everything that's there, except for certain pieces, I suppose. You know, the church bells, that's astonishing. I mean, it's like, you know, I wish we could hear what any and every composer could possibly do for, you know, for that, you know. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I don't know that you could bring that into, you know, a symphony or, you know, into a place like, you know, any kind of, like, workspace where new music occurs too, but, you know, they're open to anything and everything these days, so you never know. But there you go, that's his work, and, you know, he also wrote a piece for Pipa called Turtle and the Rat, and that will be coming up, too, in this episode, played by Yang Jing, the soloist for Pipa. And I'm also going to be featuring an entire work for violin and orchestra that Jeff wrote. The fact that it's 20 minutes, I feel, you know, we could stretch it to 20 minutes. You know, I you know, it's a podcast. Why not? Essentially, Jeff Myers is really wonderful to talk to. And I feel like, you know, he definitely deserved to win that contest, the Encores contest with Hilary Hahn, with that where she was able to include his work, The Angry Birds of Kauai, for violin and piano. And you know, it's just interesting. You know, it's interesting that, you know, there's working composers, and you kind of feel like they're established people, you know. And they might not be, you know, Beethoven or Liszt or, you know, Brahms or whatever, but they can certainly do that kind of work. You know, they certainly do, you know, put a lot of effort into, you know, the music that they do write and are very passionate about it. So, you know, I mean, in this world where, you know, everybody loves pop music and rap music and dance music, whatever, you know, it's difficult to, for people to really sort of appreciate the kind of work that goes into music that, you know, that composers put out there. And I don't know, is there any way of combating that, unless, you know, we're talking about making music more interesting to these people, you know, or simply, you know, marketing it better for today's world, you know? In any event, though, Jeff was wonderful. And of course, he was staying in California when I talked to him, so we were both on the same time zone. You know, during this interview. So anyway, here's my conversation with Jeff Myers on The Glass Show. So how's everything been now for the last few years? I mean, I would imagine, like, a lot of changes have occurred, you know, since winning the Hilary Hahn contest and having your piece, you know, featured on a major release like hers, there, right. The 27 pieces. I mean, and of course, your son is now several, you know, a couple of years old. He's getting big. He's walking around. Yeah. He's, like, carrying luggage. picture I saw? yeah, so, like, can you talk about some of these things that have been happening? And, of course, you've got many other projects, too.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. I was actually just typing an email to a woman in Marin County who's interested in doing my opera, Buried Alive.
Oh, cool.
And so I've been doing a lot of opera stuff in the last few years and chamber music. And the opera Buried Alive, it was done in Fargo in March. It was pretty exciting. That was part of kind of a long continuum of events. I took this class with American Lyric Theater about opera, and they pair you with librettists, and you work out scenes and stuff.
Wonderful. How long?
And they ended up,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
commissioning me. They ended up commissioning me to write an opera, I think 2009 or something.
Oh, okay.
So it's like this long trajectory going on in the background. So while I'm writing little pieces here and there, you know, this thing has been happening. So it finally was premiered in March, and it looks like it'll have a couple more performances.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know if we talked about Buried Alive last time,
mm-hmm.
but that's a piece you've been writing for that you've been working on that for 5 years now.
A lot of time was spent working on the libretto.
Okay.
I think from 2009 till about 2012 or 2011, we're still ironing out the libretto.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a work in progress. My libretto is plenty long.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, oh, can we change this? Can we change that? Which is kind of, as a composer, you know, I try to have all the music mapped out, and I'm like, well, as long as it's, you know, not a big change, then maybe that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
The further you get down the road with the opera, then it gets harder. It's harder to change things. It's not like a musical where you can just take some song out, put another song in, or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's all woven together.
Yeah, I know. There's like a whole tradition of that. You know, like they have to like recycle mm-hmm. things for like Broadway shows.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, like, how often does that happen where you really decide that something isn't really like finished? You have to, you know, kind of look at it and go, no, I really don't feel like I have everything here. You know, I want to like make some more, you know, finalizations to it.
I think, well, it's kind of a work in progress until maybe after the first or second performance for most pieces. I mean, first you have an idea of what it's going to be like when you write it, and then you kind of tweak it a little bit, and then mm-hmm. you have a performance, and usually some things will come out, maybe technical things or expressive things. Maybe, what's interesting is sometimes the players will say, well, what about, you know, I try it like this or try it like that, and then it's like, no, actually, that wasn't what I was thinking, but I like that too. So sometimes I'll mm-hmm. go and I'll make a little change in the score. With the Hilary Hahn piece, there were some little things here and there. She's asking, you know, what do you mean by this glissando? Do you want me to slide the whole way down, or do you want me to wait and then go down at the last minute like a portamento? You know, little stuff like that.
It must be difficult to say no to Hilary Hahn, though, if she says, like, she needs something different, you know, unless...
Yeah, I mean, that was actually in the contract with the commission.
Yeah.
It said something like, you know, if she wants to change something, then she can do it or something. And I was kind of like, yeah, that's cool.
What if she tells you, you know what, I'm just going to rewrite your whole piece and credit it to me. What do you say to that? No.
I know. I was talking back and forth. And I was kind of like, that's not going to happen, right? I mean, I know it's kind of like there in writing, I guess you could do that, but mm-hmm. they're like, no, that's not what this is about. It's more
mm-hmm.
just for some little things. And there was some stuff like she took a tempo a little quicker than I wrote in some spot,
mm-hmm.
but it's like her version is fine. I liked it. So.
You know, interpretation has...
A lot of stuff with tempo is kind of whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you kind of make an estimation.
Interpretation plays such a huge role in this music that it seems like, you know, you can't not sort of consider, you know, that the performer, you know, really is almost like another, you know, force in the writing of the piece in many cases. You know, I don't know if there's any composer that's ever said, nah, I just write it and, you know, they have to do it the way I want it or it's not the piece or something, you know.
Yeah, I think that's kind of losing sight of what's really important.
Yeah,
you know, because I can sort of understand in some ways if you have some kind of architectural idea with the music and you know, it all has to work out a certain way to realize the idea. And if they're not doing it, then it's kind of like it's not really what you wrote, and then you get frustrated.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I've kind of moved away from that a little because I used to be a little bit more like that. And, you know, there's some of these little things, like, it's not really that big of a deal if someone stretches something out a little bit or something. You know, what's more important is that it sort of comes to life and the piece has some sort of humanness to it, I think.
I was hoping to use the Angry Birds of Kauai as recorded by Hilary Hahn for this podcast. Unfortunately, the copyright restrictions forbid me to use the piece in full. In fact, even to get 20 seconds worth of it, I need special permission from their legal team, and they have not yet gotten back to me. So essentially what I am going to do is give you a few seconds of Angry Birds. Oh, wait, actually, I've been told that I am not allowed to use the Angry Birds theme music either, so I guess what we'll just do is give you a recording of birds singing. I've just been informed, actually, that the birds did not sign release forms, so... I don't know. Anyway, let's get back to the interview. And I mean, you know, like there's so many people that, like, at least I know of at least one or two guys or people that are composers or passed on, even in some cases, that were very adamant about, you know, passing their work on, like Fred Ho, for example, who just passed away earlier this year. You know, he told, you know.
But he did?
Yeah, he did.
Wow.
He
did. I didn't even
know. He died in April, yeah. And there's like a whole documentary about him and everything too. It's really wonderful. I just reviewed it.
Yeah, I met him not too long ago.
Oh, fabulous. What was he like? What was that like to meet him?
Oh, he's very nice. Yeah, he's a very nice guy.
I met him
He played with a percussionist that I knew from back when I was studying at San Jose State. I remember they worked together.
Oh, fabulous. What was his name?
Crap. I can't remember.
Not Royal Hardigan, is it, by any chance?
Yeah, Royal Hardigan.
Oh, there you go. Okay, yeah, because he's also in the movie.
Yeah, he did the African ensemble there.
Yeah, and he seems like a really cool guy, too. But Fred Ho, yeah, I met him very briefly at Marie and Contreras' premiere for the piece that she wrote called At the Other Side of the Earth. You know, it was all too brief. I mean, I really knew nothing about him at the time. All I knew was that, like, he was one of her, you know, mentors and everything. And I just kind of said, oh, yeah, Marie talked about you. You know, so it just very briefly, like, we spoke, and then, like, we just went inside and watched her piece, you know, her premiere. But, you know, like, knowing more about him is incredible. And that's, like, a whole story into itself. But, you know, the thing that's wonderful about him is that, you know, Marie told me that, like, when, you know, he said, I want you and I want, like, the orchestra to, or the band, rather, to play my music better than I would play it. You know, I'm leaving it in your hands. You know, and she essentially is like conducting his bands now, the Eco Music Big Band and the Green Monster Big Band. And that seems like a crazy idea for a composer to say, you know, you got it. This is yours now. You know, you do what you need to do with it, but it's yours because, I mean, it's out of my hands. It's almost kind of like what he's saying.
I've been more interested recently, too, in almost putting less information in the score so that the performers can kind of do what they want with it. Like, I wrote a percussion trio called Binalig, and it has very little information in the way of, like, dynamics or stuff like that. And that the percussion instruments can be variable. It's kind of like, you know, any drum you want and stuff like that. So I'm kind of interested in discovering things after I write it, as opposed to, you know, going in and saying it has to be like this and like checking every box if it's not you know, there, and then getting annoyed or something like that.
Even
it's kind of cool to come in and just discover something and say, oh wow, you know, you brought something new to my piece that I wasn't thinking about. Or
yeah, I mean, because, you know, even as a songwriter, you know, when I was in a band, I would write a song and the group would take it into a dimension I wasn't aware of. You know, it was even better than the way I dreamt it in most cases. So I suppose the same thing happens with composers and, you know, ensembles and orchestras or you know, chamber group or chamber musicians.
A good coach for chamber music can do a lot of things too. I remember in school having one of the instrumental teachers come in or something, make a few comments, and it's like, oh, that's kind of what I was going for, but I didn't even know how to say it, you know, in the score or how to explain it. And then all of a sudden it you know, makes a piece 10 times better. Little things like that.
Amazing, you know, and you know, what was that like the first time that Hillary recorded The Angry? By the way, were you there? Were you in the studio when this was recorded, or were you, like, not invited?
No, she recorded it in Germany.
Oh, okay.
And sent me a quick draft of it and said, you know, what do you think of this? And I made a couple comments. Mm-hmm. But it was already basically recorded, so I wasn't able to say, like, could you do this differently or something? But it was more of a, they had, you know, a few takes and they could reassemble it from those takes.
Did they?
But, I mean, it's sort of like with Hillary Hahn, I wasn't going to think, oh, this is going to be a disaster.
No.
It sounded pretty great anyway, so I was like, yeah.
No, yeah, definitely.
I like that.
I agree absolutely. And, you know, by the way, does Hillary still call you? As long as we're talking about
it.
No. Oh my God.
That was for YouTube or whatever. I mean, I think I sent her a picture of Max once or twice.
Mm-hmm. And she didn't write back and say, oh, he's cute and he's growing up and nothing like that at all.
She responds.
Oh,
stuff,
okay.
But, you know,
I know.
I try not to inundate her with superfluous emails or anything like that.
I know. That's kind of become what Facebook is for now, to like everybody to.
Right. Yeah, if you want to post all kinds.
By the way, I think Max looks great because we see the pictures anyway. You know, I also want to ask you about a couple of other things. The turtle and rat piece for Peepa.
Yeah.
Which was, I guess, recorded by Yang Jing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that your idea? Did she commission you personally, or was that, I mean, like, how did that come about?
It was kind of a departmental project at University of Hawaii when I was teaching there, because Donald Womack knew her personally, and he wanted to bring her in to play some of his music, and he invited, like, all the composition faculty to write a piece for her while she was there. To play at a concert. So I was like, okay, I don't know anything about Peepa, but I'll try it out. And kind of everyone else was in the same boat, like pulling out Peepa books or Peepa charts and trying to figure out how to write for it. And she did a master class and we heard our pieces and there, I learned a lot. I made a bunch of edits and there's a lot of notational things that are kind of specific for Peepa techniques. And I learned about that. And then since she was there, like, why don't we, you know, record these and then we'll see if we can pitch it to a label. So we did all the kind of recordings on spec, and then Albany Records decided to release it. They had a relationship with Donald Womack already, so that worked out really easy, actually. It was kind of nice.
And
she's a really great player, really nice person, too.
Yeah, definitely. I did hear some of
the turtle and rat piece.
That's okay.
It was kind of a weird... I was looking at, there are a lot of Micronesians in Hawaii, so I normally don't think that much about Micronesia, but it sort of was on my brain, and my wife has a Micronesian friend. And I was looking at folklore and stuff like that, and I found this weird story about the turtle and the rat and the bird who were, not to explain the whole story, but it's this kind of strange folk story. Anyways, I wanted to make a piece out of that, so that's how the turtle and rat came in. I ended up just making little character studies of the turtle and the rat. My Micronesian friend, she was going, like, I don't even know what that story is. I think someone made that up. I don't know. I was like, oh, whatever.
Well
it
it's your
me
story
a
now.
Piece,
apparently.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a piece called The Turtle and the Rat. The Turtle, the first part. The Rat was the second half. Written by Jeff Myers and performed by Yang Jing on the Pipa. And it's from an album called Elements, New Music for Pipa by American Composers. But, you know, the Pipa definitely is one of those things that makes me so excited about the possibilities for, you know, Eastern and Western music, you know, and the fact that you wrote for it is fabulous because, you know, who's to say that you can't write something for like sitar or something, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. because
they're all just instruments, right? So
yeah,
and they have different properties, I guess, as long as you can find a player.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of players with pipa, especially.
Pipas are very delicate instruments, too.
They read Western music. Yeah, yeah. And what's interesting about the pipa is that they have all these extended techniques, which are actually, in a way, part of the traditional repertoire, unlike maybe some Western instruments like violin or piano, where it's the standard practice is to play it the one way and not to, you know, do all these, you know, knocking on the instrument and playing, I don't know, with like three or four different types of vibrato which you can notate and all this kind of stuff.
But
also, it was kind of cool. They're really into just doing as many different sounds as possible as a sort of par for the course.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And, well, I mean, it's just wonderful that, like, you know, people are still recording it, you know. I mean, it's still very much a modern instrument, like Wu Man, another pipa soloist.
Yeah.
I interviewed her last year, and she's done some fabulous things. And she, you know, and she almost, like, had a very major disaster. Like, she had a pipa that she had to, like, carry with her to come and play at a festival in New Haven. And the thing, you know, they made her check the damn instrument and it broke on the plane. And they had to like scurry to find her another pipa once she got to Connecticut.
Oh,
and they managed to find one. And she said, it was good. It wasn't the same as the one that she was going to use, but, you know, she pretty much made good with it regardless, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, its value is quite huge, you know, as far as the right sound and everything. I mean, it's almost like another kind of violin or something. And
I know.
Yeah, pretty much. So You know, so basically, I mean, I thought of that when I saw that there was this piece, you know, so I just, you know, like, it's nice to know that these guys are out there, you know, and there's always going to be some really good exotic instrument to use for something, you know, if you ever get sick of writing music
like,
for violin.
Yeah.
You know.
I'd like to write more for pipa, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty cool to work with.
Well,
it has a strange kind of range because, the string tuning is, you know, it's four strings, but it's tuned in almost like a chordal kind of tuning
mm-hmm.
or something. So the fingerings they work out kind of different than if you write for violin or something. So that's why it really, really helps to have the player nearby and then ask a bunch of questions. Because
mm-hmm.
I wrote a few things that were just like impossible, which I thought, well, maybe that's kind of hard. And she's like, no, can't do it at all. You know, it's like, all right.
And you know, I mean, like even with like things like mandolin or with harp, you know, there's even more things that you can do as a solo instrument because I don't really hear a lot of harp repertoire or mandolin repertoire for that matter, you know, or guitar repertoire for that
mm-hmm.
matter for like, you know, composers that there is, you know, there is a guy named Giacomo Fiore who's, you know, he's actually sending me his record in the mail. And I'm going to
mm-hmm.
listen to it and everything, you know, and he's and like, that's an album of commissioned music for solo guitar. So,
yeah,
you know, there's always these possibilities.
I never played guitar. I'm a pianist. So for me, the guitar
yeah.
is like probably one of the hardest to understand. I tried to, my dad's a guitarist and I tried to learn guitar for a while and it was just so frustrating. I haven't really written much for guitar, but I tried once and...
Well,
it's a lot of work.
I was never really a guitarist myself, and then I really what I did was I learned a couple of basic chords on it, and I, you know, but then again, I'm you know a pop musician songwriter, so it's a little different for me. But I just basically
yeah.
just kind of found the easiest things to use on there, and that became the basis for like the songs that I wrote on guitar, you know? So, I mean, you know, I feel like
yeah.
It's a broad enough instrument. You could probably find ways of doing things on there.
That's probably why it's such a popular instrument because it could fill all these functions like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it seems like it's a pretty big jump to go from, you know, playing chords on a guitar to being like a guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
Play, like all these different voices and all this subtle stuff.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, not everybody is going to, you know, use it the same way. Just like not everybody uses, you know, the violin the same way or the, you know, the piano the same way. It's like everybody has a style,
yeah.
everybody has an identity and puts it to that
yeah.
instrument. So, you know, I feel like if somebody actually like kind of put a gun to your head and said you have to write a guitar sonata, you probably would come up with something really good, you know.
Yeah.
Hopefully
it
not
would,
using
it would
gun.
Have to take more research. Yeah. With the violin, I've, for some reason I've like been able to get in the head of a violinist because I can't play any string instrument at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I've written a lot for the violin. I have a violin concerto and I have a handful of chamber pieces with piano and stuff like that. And string.
I was just listening to the Metamorphosis Concerto again, by the way, before I called
yeah.
you. And that definitely sounds like that could be recorded by a major violinist in an orchestra. And it's got this gorgeous conclusion to it that I don't think I've ever really heard before.
I would like that very much.
Definitely.
It's hard to get stuff out. I mean, I've sent the piece out to different orchestras and given it to different people. I gave a recording to Hillary. Even.
Mm-hmm.
I won a couple awards for it when I was a student. It's a good piece. I actually produced a small version of it for string orchestra and piano with the soloist
mm-hmm.
at Le Poisson Rouge back in 2008.
Oh, that like a chamber cool. version.
Yeah, it was like a string orchestra version. And it still worked out pretty well.
Well, I definitely hope that you have some kind of success with it in the future. And, you know, and I really do hope maybe somebody will pick it up and do it, you know, because it's definitely a killer piece, mm-hmm. I think.
Thank you.
That's Jeff's Metamorphosis Concerto for Violin and Orchestra with David Gilbert as the soloist, and the orchestra was the Eastman Philharmonia. And what's new for you? What are the new things that are coming up? What premieres that are that we should be looking out for?
There's a Dutch pianist, Ralph Van Ratt,
mm-hmm.
who has some recordings with John Adams and Jetski and stuff like that. He's going to be playing a little piano piece of mine in Princeton. I don't know the exact date yet. I don't know if it's on his website, but that's in November. I'd like to get him in the studio. Maybe I can record it or
mm-hmm.
something. And that piece is called Three Sketches. It's just a little piece, like 5 minute
mm-hmm.
kind of sampler. And then
solo
piano.
Okay.
I'm writing a piece for Load Bang, which is Jeff Gavitt's quartet of baritone, trumpet, bass clarinet, and trombone. So I was Skyping with him
mm-hmm.
a few days ago, and he was singing some stuff in different ways for me to get an idea of what he could do. That piece is almost pretty much done. I just want to hear them play it a little bit
mm-hmm.
and think about some of the balance issues, because there's got to be some weird balance issues.
They're pretty good. I like them. I saw them at the there was like a Cage festival going on in New York a few
yeah.
years ago, and they were part of this big show where they did several a cappella pieces, and they also were part of the concerto, the concert for piano and ensemble, and you know, like the
mm-hmm.
yeah, they were a big part of that, and they were one of many people that were like using their voices for the piece.
Mm-hmm.
They're
really good with microtonal and just intonation stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that the piece I wrote features, it has an electronic drone, which is basically a sample of a piano harmonic, which is stretched out over several minutes. And
mm-hmm.
they can kind of sing the harmonics, or Jeff can sing the harmonics and the players. I wrote in some just intonational stuff for seventh harmonic and stuff like that. So that would be kind of cool. Not everyone can do that stuff, but I wanted to write it for them in particular because I know that they'd be really excited about doing that. Kind of like when I wrote for Jack Quartet, when I wrote Dopamine, because I know they also hear that stuff
mm-hmm.
and they can play it really well.
And
that kind of stuff excites me a lot lately, all this just intonation or microtonal things.
And what about the Requiem? Wasn't that was a premiere too, wasn't it, recently that the Jack Quartet played?
Oh, well, actually, what happened was they played a workshop.
Oh, okay.
And they just basically, it was like an open rehearsal
mm-hmm.
of half of the piece. So that was that's about 45 minutes long. That's for string quartet and soprano, so Martha Kluver plus Jack Quartet. And then that's going to happen at Trinity Wall Street on March 12th next year.
Oh, so it probably gives you time if you have to rewrite anything or revise anything, or if, you know.
I don't know if I need that much time at this point.
Oh, okay.
I'll probably, you know, meet with him for a couple of days and work out some things, and that'll be it. I mean, they're so adept. They'll probably tell me what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, yeah, okay.
yeah. I will.
The only other issue is to hear it in the space, because I want to have a lot of reverb in the space, and it's mm-hmm. kind of meant to be like a resonant kind of sounding piece.
Hopefully they're not going to wait until the night of to tell you they need something changed, you know?
An hour before.
Yeah, an hour.
Oh, by the way,
yeah.
See this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, God, no. And how does, I mean, I don't know, this is probably a dumb question, but how does one write a Requiem in this day and age? You know, it seems like...
Yeah, I mean, no, like, that's not a dumb question. I think, for me, it was super personal because it's dedicated to my sister-in-law who passed away
okay.
from an aneurysm. I mean, it's not really about that necessarily, but I wanted to do something for her
mm-hmm.
and write this piece. So I basically looked around for a lot of poetry and things that related to death, or texts that related to death, that I thought I could weave into a kind of narrative
mm-hmm.
that explored it without being dogmatic in any particular philosophy or religion. So there's some stuff in there from Rumi. There's some stuff from some poetry like Oscar Wilde, and I used Kyrie Eleison and a little bit of Latin text in there. So it's kind of a mishmash of different things.
It's in a...
With my experience with death, it just seemed very, as an atheist, it seemed very kind of pluralistic to me. I mean, I was sort of observing how different cultures deal with it without really identifying with any of them. So I wanted to have a kind of open look at death and grieving and stuff in the piece. I don't know if that means the piece is going to come off as kind of like if there's not enough commitment towards any idea, but that's kind of what I was going for. It's looking at all these different poets and how they thought about death, and you can kind of draw your own conclusion, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, because you know, I've had discussions and I've written about the fact that, you know, you have so much music that has, you know, like a Christian meaning, you know, or like any kind of allusion to God and God and biblical terms. And, you know, I kind of found myself telling people, well, you know, a lot of people are sort of speaking in a very open way that they don't necessarily believe in religion, you know, and God is really, and the whole thing about, you know, that everybody needs to sort of be like serious about prayer and serious about church. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the public feeling is leaning more towards, we don't necessarily need to rely on it very much, you know, and being that, you know, for the last several years, I've sort of gone from being a Republican to, you know, not necessarily a Democrat, but like an independent thinker, you know, like, is it wrong for me to say I love Handel's Messiah? I've been like listening to it and singing along with it since, you know, a very early age in my life. And yet, you know, it's like, I don't necessarily, you know, celebrate Easter or, you know, the same way that I used to. So, you know, I mean, is it weird to say that, you know, I really love the Messiah, even though, you know, I haven't really gone to church since I was about 18, you know?
Right. And I remember when I was singing in a choir, there's a lot of pieces that are just, it's almost like you're in church singing some of these pieces, but you're just in a secular choir, but there's so much repertoire that's based around Christianity and stuff like that. It's almost like, I don't know if there's, I mean, I have a choral piece it's kind of in the same vein. It's questioning God and kind of trying to get away from that and stuff. And I haven't had really any success with that. I wonder if it's because partially it's a lot of this Christianity heavy repertoire out there. If it doesn't go with it or something. I don't know.
Well,
it's also in Polish, so that's probably part of it.
Oh, there you go. You know, maybe you should just write it in Polish and not everybody will know that you're really what you're really saying. So, but that's the thing, you know. I mean, I and yet, like, music to me, it just speaks so loudly that, you know, I don't necessarily have to know everything about what the text is. You know, I know that, you know, we have a God and we have Christ. They you know, they forgive our sins, and that's I feel like that's all we need to really kind of have as an understanding with them, you know. And, you know, if we really have to be like religious, it's like, well, okay, you know what, I believe in God, I believe in Jesus, and that's, you know, that's where, there we go, you know. There should be an unconditional like rule going on with that, you know.
In my Requiem, I use, you know, Kyrie Eleison, and that's pretty much it. To me, I sort of boiled down all of that, you know, credo and all these little details into just basically, you know, have mercy on us, Lord. You know, it's sort of like at the moment when you're grieving the most, you need to hold on to something. So if you're Christian, or even if you're raised Christian or something, I think you kind of revert back to that, and you're sort of crying out to God. And that's kind of, for me, the essence of Christianity. Because if you're going in your day-to-day life, I mean, like I said, I'm not Christian at all, but it just that's the way my interpretation is.
Mm-hmm.
In your day-to-day life, a lot of times there's a lot of things going on. You don't think about God that much or something. But at some of these points in life where you're really stressed, it seems like that's where that comes in the strongest. You know,
mm-hmm.
You're willing to just say, I don't, you know, maybe it doesn't seem logical, but I still want to believe in God anyways mm-hmm. because I need that so badly.
You know, I just talked to the band Death, the punk band from the 70s that they made a big movie about and everything, and it was a wonderful interview I did yesterday, but they were basically a Baptist minister, you know, or whatever. They were like a you know, like a Christian family. And they still pray, you know. They're even though like the music they did really, you know, isn't always indicative of that. But you know, like when they had to get back together to play with the new guitarist who was replacing David Hackney, the one that passed away, he started playing and they had to like leave the room and they were in tears and everything. And one of them said in the movie, you know, I had to like pray to God and say, get me through this, you know, you know, he just wasn't ready for what was happening because it was just coming back to them. So in such a hard way that they were like, oh God, you know, this is going to be like, you know, getting on a roller coaster or something, you know? So, you know, I mean, apparently, like, for a lot of people, like, religion is a real thing. You know, it's a very, you know, it's a very visceral thing that they, you know, it's like they can't not use it somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
That's very real.
Yeah. I know, it's a real example there, you know. So, it's, and of course, you know, I loved that. So, you know, that's another great thing to check out.
Jeff Myers on The Glass Show. Wonderful conversation. I didn't think we would start getting, you know, into like religion there, but that was interesting. And I started bringing up all these other things, you know, it's like, it's weird. Like, cause once you start talking about that and you start bringing up other people that you've talked to and other, you know, sometimes I worry about that if it gets too personal or if it becomes too much about me or something, you know? And I hope that didn't come across that way. But in any event, wonderful chat. And a couple of things of note. Today is his birthday. So happy birthday to Jeff Myers. I'm publishing this. It's just kind of by coincidence that we're publishing this on his birthday. I didn't necessarily plan it that way. It's just that by the time I got around to it, it just happened to be that time. And unfortunately, too, very sadly, his mother, Paula, had passed away not too long after we recorded this interview. So my heartfelt condolences go out to Jeff and his family. And, you know, I know what that's like. My mother died 7 years ago, and actually now almost 8 years ago, because that was at the end of 2006. So it's never easy, you know. I just only hope that, you know, our moms are up there looking down on us and are happy that we're doing some, you know, things that we like to do. And I wish the same for him and his mom, too. So, Jeff, thank you. And thank you so much to Jeff Myers for doing this show. I really appreciate it, and I hope things continue to go well for him and for his music, and particularly for things like the Metamorphosis Violin Concerto, because it definitely deserves to be part of the orchestral repertoire, for sure, you know. Anyway, I'm Chris McGovern, and thank you for listening to The Glass, and there's going to be more great episodes coming up and some more reboots, too, of older episodes, so please stay tuned. Thank you.